Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
I feel a little like David going out to meet Goliath to be in this group. I went to a little Baptist school where you had to go to chapel services unless you were senior. And what the seniors did, they rented their bodies to sit in other people's chairs for $10 a week. But I remember sitting there, I used to think, that speaker wasn't doing good, and he wasn't dressed right, and he didn't act right, and he didn't say right. I've always feared being asked to go back and speak at that college, because I think I know what the people are thinking about. And I think most of you have stereotyped me. Most of you think you know what I'm going to say, and I'm going to blow your socks off. Because you don't know what I'm going to say. And I want to try to show you where I'm coming from so that you can catch the flavor of what I think is the biblical attitude and not the cultural attitude toward alcohol and alcohol abuse. I come from a divorced family where all of my family is alcoholics, both my close family and my extended family are alcoholics. I learned to cope not by doing, but by drinking. And I was pretty well trapped myself. I just didn't feel like I could be in front of any group without drinking. Matter of fact, when I started to preach, I thought I'd have to drink vodka or gin, something they couldn't smell, before I'd get up in front of people. And I was serious about that. I really had that kind of fear and inadequacy and just a non-development of coping skills. But since then, I have been able, through the grace of God, to overcome that. And now I bring some expertise that I would like to share with you. My expertise are not as a pastor, because I'm really not a pastor as much as I am a teacher. But I am trained in the art of hermeneutics. And that is what I want to present to you. I do not want to be real emotional or judgmental or whatever. I want to present to you, as a trained interpreter of ancient literature, both the process by which I'm going to interpret and the fruit of my interpretations. And I want to do it in a verifiable way that you can check me up if you want to. And I hope you will. Because what I tell you about what the Bible says, most of you are not going to agree with. You need to be mad as the devil or so excited. And probably both of those reactions I'm nervous about. You notice that number one, I've talked about biblical authority. And the only hat that I feel comfortable wearing at this point is the hat of a theologian. And so I'll wear that hat, and I'm not ashamed of it. But I want to back up what I'm going to say with the presuppositions that I think maybe you're already familiar with. I believe there is an absolute. I believe the Bible is the self-revelation of the only Creator, Redeemer, God. But now when I say that, you're saying, you think you're right. That's not at all what I'm saying. I believe there's an absolute. I don't believe my interpretation of the absolute is right. I just want to assert I believe there's an absolute, and that is the Scriptures. I am a sinful man. It has affected every aspect of my life, including my understanding of the absolute. And so I want to assert there is the absolute, and I've committed my life to trying to find out what that absolute means in the written form as well as in a personal relationship. Now, I believe that most of the sermons I hear, whether on television, from pulpits, my own old ones that I go back and listen to, books I read, I think most that I hear in God's name is cultural and not biblical. Now, I define biblical authority in this way and in this way only. You know, we think if someone carries a family Bible and quotes the Scripture a lot that they're biblical. That is not true. Biblical authority is first trying to find out what the author was saying to the people of his day. And then once you understand that, you can apply that truth to your day. The Bible is not like the morning newspaper that you can read your 20th century Bible Belt definitions in, or your personal experience, and then just apply it to your culture. It is not that. It is a very ancient book, removed from us not only by culture and time, but by language. And the only way to get back to the man on the street of Isaiah's day or Jesus' day is to pay a price of historical grammatical research. I believe the Bible was written to the man on the street, not the scholar. Not the philosopher. I think the man who sat at Jesus' feet in the Sermon on the Mount understood immediately what Jesus was saying. I think the man who heard Jeremiah speak in the temple knew immediately what he was saying, but we're a long way from there. And it takes some effort to get back in that biblical framework, that ancient framework, and that's what I want to try to do. Under number C, I want to admit to you where I'm coming from and try to tell you what I'm going to try to do when I begin in just a minute. I am what's called a historical grammatical exegete. Now, I've taken something for it, and it's not catching, so don't be nervous. But basically what that means is, after the death of the apostles, there developed two major schools of biblical interpretation. One developed in Alexandria, Egypt, the site of the very famous library, the site of where the Septuagint was traditionally supposed to be interpreted in 250 B.C. There lived there a man named Philo, who was a Jewish exegete. He was basically a Neoplatonist, and he tried to bring the Old Testament and make it relevant to his Greek philosophical Hellenistic tradition, and the only way to do that was to spiritualize or allegorize the text. And he set a precedent in that city of what we call allegorizing or spiritualizing. Example, the parable of the Good Samaritan is really not the parable of a Samaritan person going from Jericho to Jerusalem, but that is really a picture of man from his fallen nature trying to move toward heaven. Now, that would be spiritualizing that parable. And my understanding was there really was a guy. He really was a Samaritan. He really got, you know, beat up, and the other guy helped him, and on and on. I am more of a historical person. Now, my school or background is known as the Antiochian school. And if you can think of a biblical map, you know that Alexandria is in Egypt. But I followed a school that developed about 200 years later, known as the Antiochian school, the literal school, or the historical grammatical school. You may be familiar with some of the people who started that. Lucian, Theodore Mopsuestha, and many other great interpreters of the church believe that the Bible must be taken for what it really says on face value. Now, that doesn't mean if the trees clap their hands and the hills skip for joy. That's poetry. And so obviously that's not taken literal. But when someone walks from Jericho to Jerusalem, that's literal, and you take it that way. Now, I'm going to try to back up what I say about the Bible, because I think it's really important that it's somewhat verifiable, from five areas that I think are crucial in you understanding what the ancient text is trying to say. I want to do, if possible, the etymology of Hebrew or Greek words. I want to look at the syntax of the language. Is a word put out of place or a special kind of literary construction? So syntax, etymology, syntax, parallel passages, that way the Bible interprets itself without our definitions. Context, which we so often forget because we're a proof-texting society on the Bible, and finally, the customs and manners of the day. From those five areas, I'm going to try to present to you what I believe the Bible, and not denomination 20th century cultural garbage, says about alcohol and alcoholism. And I'm going to do all that in the next 30 minutes. Something like crossing the Red Sea, I think. But let's look at the biblical terms first, if I might. I've listed three Hebrew terms that really form the basis for the Greek term, and the Greek term there is synonymous with the most widely used Hebrew term. There is a Hebrew term used 141 times in the Old Testament that's usually translated in English, wine, okay? And you see it there. It is very uncertain what the etymology of this word is, because this is not a Semitic root. It is not a Hebrew root. They borrowed it from some other language, and we're not sure of the derivation from the other language. So wine is the best I can do. I don't know if it means sugar or drips or screams or what. We just don't know. The etymology is uncertain. I've given you a few typical examples of where it's used. It is always used for fermented fruit juice. And because we're in Palestine primarily with the Bible, it's usually grape juice. There is a few mentioning in the Bible of pomegranate, maybe one raisin. We know from culture that dates could be made into an alcoholic beverage, but primarily it's grapes in Palestine, and so wine is the typical translation. There's another term, you see it there, number two. This means new wine. Now, I get tickled to death with theologians who have a bias, obvious bias. They know that Jesus could not do something, and so they have to change the meaning of the word. I got a little joke. Any of you ever read the joke book called Brother Blotz? You go, oh, it's good. Oh. Brother Blotz is standing at a blackboard. He's got the Greek word for wine up there. And he's saying to his seminary class, this word always means wine, except in passages about the Lord's Supper where it means grape juice. You hear the bias. Okay. Many people try to say that new wine is unfermented grape juice. Now, I just want to be very honest with you, and you check me up. Fermentation of grape juice in a hot climate begins 6 hours after you squeeze the grape. 6 hours fermentation starts. Now, the Jewish people, they were very concerned about how and when to do things. And you know, you do grapes in a vat, and it goes into another vat, and it goes into another vat. The minute, within 6 hours, that foam began to appear on the top of the second vat, they said, it's already wine, and it must be tithed. Another motive there, but the ferment was already happening by the time they got to the second vat, much less later. New wine, biblically speaking, is wine in the process of fermentation. Now, it starts within 6 hours. There is a violent fermentation for about a week. You can't put it in wineskins. It'll break them. You got to put it in jars and leave the lid off. After a week, it can be placed in wineskins. And then for the next 40 days, it takes to become fully fermented. And you can pretty well keep wine that's fermented for about a year until it starts turning into vinegar. Okay? This means wine in the process of fermentation. And I've listed some typical passages for you there. Now, the last term is the term for strong drink. It's used about 38 times in the Old Testament. The same Hebrew root that means strong drink is the same Hebrew root for drunkard or drinking. The Hebrew word for feast is the word for drinking. Okay? Now, this is when you add something to wine, be it myrrh or mixed in other kind of spices, that accentuates the alcoholic content. And so we would, in our culture, this would be hard liquor, and the other would be more mild forms like beer or wine, something like that. When I did this yesterday, I know you can't, maybe there's a typo in here. And then three, if you look up Isaiah 11:27, and the chapter only goes to verse 12, you will think I'm a new. So just take out 11:27, and I don't know where I got that from. So, okay. Now, the Greek word that corresponds to the Hebrew, you see it there, oinos, and it just is, it's the general term for wine, okay? And it's used so often in the New Testament. Now, let me go to biblical usage, if I could, and I want to make a lot of this because I think when I'm talking to a teetotaling church group or talking to people who advocate total abstinence, I want to make this point real clear. And I want you to see where I'm making it from. I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm going to read it out of here. Now, knowing this crowd, if I said turn your Bibles, that'd be kind of dumb. So I'll read it to you. I'm under number one. Wine is a gift of God. And I want to look at Genesis 27:28. And now may God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and the abundance of grain and new wine. New wine is a gift of God. And I'll give you even a better one if you'll look at Psalms 104:14-15. And the only reason I quote 14 is because that's where God's name is mentioned. And it says, he causes the grass to grow, ... and wine which makes men's heart glad. You mean God gives wine? Now, friends, you don't get real happy on grape juice unless you're strange. So basically, here we have fermented wine as a gift from God. Now, these other passages are equally as I could read them, and they would say the same thing. And if you're interested, look them up. So wine, fermented wine, is a gift from God. Now, that is a biblical position. It is used over and over. You cannot deny that. You may not like it, but you can't deny it if you're looking at it biblically. The text is the only criteria, not our preconceived bias or cultural conditioning. Now, number two, wine was used, fermented wine is all there is. Wine was used as a part of the offerings to God. It was not corrupt. It was not considered sin. It was not a terrible thing. It was part of the normal offerings given to God. And I've listed several of them there in number two. You can look them up. Wine is considered a medicine. And I want to read you just one. Proverbs 31:6-7. Add the 7 there if you would on number 3. Proverbs 31:6-7. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. all my life. Folks said, you just drink because you want to forget. Well, sometimes Lord knows we need to forget. There, right there, is a passage on, and I'll get the New Testament ones. There are some more right there. Now, when I say wine is a gift from God, and wine is a part of the sacrifices, and wine was used as medicine, I also want to say another biblical perspective is that wine can be a major problem. And I've listed all these people for you. You know Noah's problem. Lot, I hope you know the story of what happened to him. And all the way through here are people who had major problems with drinking. It caused a disruption in their family life, in their vocational life, in their wisdom, in their sense of justice. I tell you what, Amos 4:1 says, the fat cows of Bashan are getting drunk all day and seeing their husbands out just to get more wine. Oh, society. Number five, warnings against abuse. And I want to read some of these because I really want to hit a balance. And that is that this thing is a gift from God, but there's danger here. Both of those are true, good statements that can live in the same house. Listen to a few of these, if you would. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a broiler. Whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. And then Proverbs 23 is probably one of the most humorous pictures of a man who is inebriated. Who has woes? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At last it bites like a serpent, it stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. You ever been there? Your mind will utter perverse things. You ever been there? Listen to the next one. I've done this so many times I get sick thinking about it. You will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, like one who lies down on the top of a mast. You ever been just cropped out of your gourd and closed your eyes? They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I didn't even know it. Then I shall awake, and I will seek another drink. Terrible picture, isn't it? But accurate of what happens. And then Proverbs 31, 4 and 5. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, for rulers to desire strong drink, lest they drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all of the afflicted. Okay? And there are several more here I guess I could read, but don't need to. The Bible says that wine, or fermented liquids, fruit juices, is a gift from God, but that they bite like a snake if they're not handled properly. Now, that is a dialectic. And I want to get to that in just a moment after I present all this. Certain groups abstained from wine for various reasons. The priest could not drink it while on duty. No one wants a crock priest. The Nazarites couldn't drink it because of a special commitment to God. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. The rulers were not to drink it because of the problem of justice. And I've listed Isaiah 56, 11, and 12. You might want to add Proverbs 31, 4, and 5 there. I left it out. Wine is used in eschatological sense, and that's just a dollar and a half word I learned at seminary, but I'm so proud of it I won't give it up. And that means in time, when Jesus comes again, we're going to sit down at the messianic banquet. I had a lady in one of my churches in East Texas say, Bob, are we going to eat in heaven? And I said, gee, I really don't think we're going to. She said, well, I don't want to go then. All her life, she'd been wanting to eat without results, and heaven didn't have eaten, she just didn't want to participate. So I looked and looked and looked, and I found in rabbinical literature that on the great messianic feast that God is going to kill Leviathan and Behemoth, the great land monster, the great sea monster, and we're going to have one gigantic barbecue. And Jesus even told his friends, he said, I'll not drink of the fruit of the vine until you see me again coming in my kingdom. Which means, I know we're a little nervous about partying now, but you wait till Jesus comes again. We got a party coming you won't believe. And you see the verses there in the Old Testament. Now let me come to the interbiblical period. And lest anyone be said that I'm not, I'm locked into a Protestant deal, I'm going to quote from an apocryphal book. Lo and behold, I even have one. I'm a Protestant. This is from the Wisdom of Ben Sira called Ecclesiasticus. And I want to read his position, which probably accurately describes what the attitude of rabbinical Judaism from the time of Malachi, about 450 B.C., until the coming of Jesus around. And he was born about 4 B.C. Okay, listen, this is Ecclesiastes. Wine is like life to men, if you drink it in moderation. What life has a man who is without wine? For it was created to give the gladness to men, an exhilaration to the heart, and gladness to the soul. Is wine drunk at the proper time and in sufficient quantity? Bitterness to the soul is much drinking of wine. Amidst irritation and conflict, drunkenness increases the anger of a foolish man to his injury, reducing his strength and causing wounds. That is Ecclesiasticus, the wisdom of Ben Sirach, chapter 31, verses 27 through 30. And that basically is the intertestamental attitude about drinking. Now let's come to the New Testament. And I realize I'm going to start going up the stream and across the grain, but I hope you'll write down your reactions and look in your own Bible before you throw anything on the table in this direction. Jesus drank wine. Now, dude, you can make it new wine if you want to, but it's hard to get the grapes from out of a little purple pod into his mouth than 6 hours. When Jesus came to the wedding feast of Cana, John 2, 1 and following, he turned 6 large containers of water into wine. I think it's a symbol of fulfilling up Judaism, if you want a theological interpretation. But the trick is, the guy who was the master of the feast said, bring me a cup of it. And he drank it and said, how different. Usually, they serve the best wine first and then give you the cheap wine after you're too crocked to tell the difference. But this feast is different. They gave us the cheap stuff first, and this is great stuff. Jesus. That's pretty wild wedding, wasn't it? 6 large containers? What a meeting that was. Jesus, in Luke 7, 33 and 34, they say John the Baptist came not drinking, but Jesus came eat and drinking with sinners, and he is called a wine bibber. Now, John the Baptist was a total abstainer because of number 6, but Jesus freely interacted socially with the people of his day, and the natural course of dinner and feast was fermented wine. Now, it's used as a medicine. You can see the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10:34. Jesus was offered wine on his way to being crucified. It's called vinegar, but what that is just wine that's too old for the rich people to use, and the poor people used it. And the women of Jerusalem would add spices to this. It would almost became a numbing drug they gave to condemned criminals as they were walking them to the place of crucifixion. Once Jesus tasted what it was, he wouldn't accept it. But later on the cross, before he spoke his last few words, they gave him vinegar to drink. I think his mouth was so dry he couldn't speak, and he had a few more things to say. He took the wine on the cross, and it's called vinegar, and that is no question it could be. It's hard to have unfermented vinegar. You really got to work a whole lot. The leaders of the church, by the way, 1 Timothy 5:23, that's what Paul says, Timothy, don't be such a teetotaler. Don't drink water only. Take a little wine for your stomach. Okay? Now, notice the leaders are not to be abusers. I got real tickled one time. We elected some new deacons, and we were going to talk about what the criteria was. And someone said, well, they've got to be total abstainers. I said, well, I'd like you to turn your Bible to 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. It does not say total abstainers there. Does anybody know offhand what it says there? Not addicted to much wine. It does not say any wine. It says much wine. And that is the list all the way through here of leaders, if you want to look. There's wine in the eschatological setting of the New Testament. Now, drunkenness is deplored, and you can read any one of those in number 5 and get the same harsh words toward drunkenness in the New Testament that you get in the Old. Well, that basically is a quick overview of what I want to do. Now I want to come to try to interpret that some. I am a dialectical theologian, which means that I believe we have made major problems in the religious community by basing it on either-or theological context. It's either predestination or it's free will. It's either original sin or it's volitional sin. It's either, you know, the Bible is a divine book or the Bible is a human book. I think we have done major damage to the truth of the Bible by putting it in categories. Now, the reason we do that is because we're so influenced by Western Greek categories. Everything's got to be an outline to us, or we're not comfortable with it. The Bible is not primarily an outline. It is a relationship book. It is meant to bring man into confrontation with God. Once it has done that, its major purpose is finished. It's very hard to make a rule book out of a relationship book. Though we've worked at it so long, we've done a pretty good job. Dialectical tension means that two things that seem to be opposite can be true at the same time. I believe that biblically speaking, now, I'm not giving my personal opinion, I'm saying as a Bible exegete, that fermented juice is a gift from God. That is one pole. The other pole is, it can be very dangerous, it can destroy life, it can take away wisdom, it can ruin families, on and on. It is good, it can be evil. Now, people always ask me, don't you come from the evangelical community? Yes, I do. And I come from a particular evangelical community that has been an advocate of total abstinence. How do I live with my, and I am a Bible person primary and denominational person second, third, fourth, fifthly. How can I live in a community of total abstinence when I don't believe what the Bible teaches? I think we have to realize that American culture has a problem with alcohol unusual among the cultures of the world. There is a cultural problem here with fermented drinks that is not universal among all the cultures and all the people. So what I tell people that want my theological opinion about alcohol is this. It is a gift from God. It can be abused. Because of our culture, listen to me, because of our culture, because I am a preacher of Jesus Christ, I do not want anybody to turn off my message about Jesus because of some personal freedom or idiosyncrasy to which I cling to. Therefore, I limit my life for the sake of the gospel, and I personally do not drink, though I would never tell you or my children that this is what they must do. I have come to the place of such freedom in Jesus Christ that I have been able to lay down my freedom for Him. And I feel very comfortable living a life much more rigid than I believe is necessary. But I do it for others. But let me say again, the moment that the medical community says total abstinence is better, or that the religious community says total abstinence is better, I think both of them are overstating their position. We must come to a decision on this based on who we are, not on large group rules or settings. I cannot decide for you how you will handle a gift from God that can cause major problems. I do not know. I cannot answer for you. I have answered for me, and I will live and die by what I believe for me, but I would never, never assume to put my standards on you. Now, the tendency to go beyond God-given bounds. I believe that God is the source of all things. And when Genesis is completed, it says, when everything was created, the Bible says it is very good. Our basic problem in the area of alcohol is that we try to make the stuff the problem. You've heard the phrase, demon rum. There are no demons in rum. We always try to blame someone else for our responsibility problem. Now, friends, when we make a bottle of liquor on the shelf, the enemy, we have totally misunderstood that the enemy is not in stuff, it's in us. We are the problem. We are the abusers. I used the illustration earlier in a workshop, and I like to use it again. People are screaming about the problem of cocaine use in America. We want more dogs to sniff that stuff out, more agents to bust these dealers. Cocaine is not the problem. If you had major non-surgical cancer, you would thank God for the little white juice that comes out of a poppy plant. If you just got shot in battle, you would thank God for a needle full of heroin. But when heroin consumes the life of a person until it becomes the only desire of their life is to get more and more and more, heroin has become a problem. But the problem is not heroin. The problem is the abuse and misuse of heroin. It's exactly true of alcohol. You cannot condemn alcohol and the alcohol industry in toto. You cannot do it. I'm sure there's some good people and bad people in that industry, just as there are good people and bad people in AA, and just as there are effective and non-effective counselors. Man has taken every one of God's gifts beyond God-given bounds. I am a real advocate of sex. I vote every time for it. I think it's wonderful stuff. I plan on continuing to use that gift of God. But would you agree with me that in our culture there's become a problem of sex beyond the bounds, not only of social propriety, but of the God-given bounds in which it was given? Now, sex is not the problem. It's not nude people on television that's the problem. It's not a beer ad on television the problem. You can't solve the problem of alcohol abuse by taking alcohol ads off the TV. Just like you can't solve the problem of overeating by voting the restaurant's ad. Why do those turkeys put that hamburger on at 10:30 at night? I can just kill them. At 10:30, I've already eaten. I'm supposed to be jogging my little bouncer thing, and here comes an ad for Red Lobster. It is a sin. But the problem is not in Red Lobster. The problem is in me. The problem is man has perverted, misused, and abused every gift from God, but we dare not deny the gift of God. We dare not. Abuse is not in things. There is nothing evil in physical things. Transcultural application. We must be very careful, ladies and gentlemen, that we do not extrapolate our personal experiences in the area of alcohol and make them universal norms to which everybody must abide. If your child is an alcoholic, or you have been an alcoholic, or your next door neighbor was run over by an alcoholic, or your preacher got drunk and you knew it and discouraged you, you're going to have a bias against it that will color all other things. I one time got taken off a radio station in Dallas because I presented this as a Christian radio station. The guy called me and said, "You're teaching heresy and I'm taking you off." I said, "Wait a minute. What did I say is unbiblical?" He said, "My parents were killed by a drunk last week and I'm taking you off." Well, you see what I did. I didn't hit his Bible interpretation. What did I hit? I hit his existential pain. You cannot let your personal experience be the universal norm in this whole area, and you cannot let your religious, theological, denominational, traditional, cultural glasses be the norm for all people. Friends, we wear these things. You know that, don't you? What someone told us, what mother once said, what our favorite preacher said, what we've always heard in our churches. This cannot be the norm. Most biblical truth in our day has been so overlaid with cultural garbage that it is very difficult to get back to an original biblical truth without jumping over sacred cows from every denomination. Friends, you hit one of those, you never heard a moo like you heard to know things. Man has not changed. He is basically the same. He still tends to be egocentric, and he still tends to pull all things to himself. More for me and mine at any cost. That is the basic problem of alcoholism, not alcohol. That can only be handled, I believe, with a spiritual answer. Now make it AA, make it positive thinking, make it what you will. I, as a minister of Jesus Christ, know that as a man trapped by alcohol and going down the sociological tube of destruction, that Jesus Christ did a wonderful thing for me. And I'm so glad. Only apply universal truth, never cultural changing forms. It's a tragedy when we spend developed programs. Over years we develop programs, and when we institute them, the culture has so changed that the programs are out of date. Now, I have presented to you a presuppositional opinion about the Bible and problems. And I know that I'm talking to a scientific community to some extent, at least a community of those in the area of the humanities. And so I want to say one thing before I leave. For I believe I have been stereotyped by you, and I want to try to break out in a small way. You said, well, that's just a preacher. He just tries to walk by faith, and he's subjective, but I'm objective. You may tell you the greatest can of worms in modern academia is psychology. I can quote Moses, who can you quote? See, the trick is we think that somehow answers that come from the spiritual realm are inferior to answers that come from the scientific realm. Let me remind you that all human knowledge is presuppositional. Science is as presuppositional as religion. If it wasn't for uniformitarian theories, science couldn't extrapolate back before the period of gaining statistical analysis. No, we all walk by faith. And the truth is that the scientific theories and the religious theories that seem so popular in our day pass away like the morning clouds, and we're left to struggle again with man pulling everything toward himself at any cost.